Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents China and Russia, Four Centuries of Conflict and Concord by Philip Snow, narrated by Michael Page. Note on names and romanization. My object throughout has been to use those forms of Chinese and Russian names I felt would be most familiar to the ordinary Western listener. Personal names. For Chinese names, I have used the now standard pinyin system of romanization, except in cases such as Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek, where a traditional spelling has been long established. Having made an exception in Chiang Kai-shek's case, it seemed logical to make another one for his son Chang Ching-kuo. For Russian names, I have followed the conventional U.S. Library of Congress system, with some modifications where another form is in general use. Place names. My preference has been to use those Chinese and Russian names that were current in the West in the period under discussion. For the greater part of the four centuries covered by this book, the northern Chinese capital was known to the Western world as Peking, until the summer of 1979, when the Chinese authorities decreed that it should from now on be universally rendered Beijing. This was entirely logical, in the sense that Beijing is the correct pronunciation of the name in Mandarin Chinese. However, to refer to Beijing in a 17th or 19th century context, as many Western writers now do, seems to me to introduce a grating note of modernity. I have consequently retained Peking for the first seven chapters of the book, switching over to Beijing only in the final contemporary chapter, where the new form was wholly appropriate. I have used the same principle in naming the southern Chinese capital and the major city of Guangdong province, referring to these respectively as Nanking and Canton for the first seven chapters, as Nanjing and Guangzhou only in the eighth. In discussing the 1950s, I have referred to the nationalist-held islands in the Taiwan Straits by the names which were widely current for them at that time, Kemoi and Matsu, rather than by the now standard but unfamiliar forms of Jinmen and Mazu. In the Russian case, similarly, I have referred to the sometime capital as St. Petersburg in chapters 2 and 3, as Leningrad in chapters 4 to 7, the Soviet period, and as St. Petersburg again in the post-Soviet chapter 8. Absolute consistency is impossible. I have, for example, ignored names that were current for some of these cities for relatively short periods, such as Petrograd in Russia from 1914 to 1924, and Beiping or Peiping in China from 1928 to 1949, since to introduce these could only make for confusion. Certain other Chinese cities, which I have alluded to by their modern pinyin names such as Tianjin and Xiamen, could arguably have been left in their old spellings of Tianjin and Amoy, but this seemed to me less essential than in the cases of Peking, Nanking, and Canton. I only hope I have done enough to guide the listener and make the atmosphere of these chapters more authentic than it might otherwise be. Introduction. Ever since they emerged from the rubble of the Second World War, Western societies have looked with apprehension on either Russia or China or both. During the 1950s, they were alarmed by the Grand Alliance between the two communist giants, the greatest challenge to Western supremacy, in the judgment of one scholar, since the Ottoman armies sat at the gates of Vienna. That alliance collapsed amid acrimony. But Western apprehension continued, with the main focus of dread shifting periodically from one to the other of the two former allies. For a few years following the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, the Soviet Union was viewed with a degree of indulgence as China plunged into the xenophobic frenzy of the Cultural Revolution. An optimist, it was said, was someone who learnt Russian, a pessimist someone who learnt Chinese. The Soviet Union's stock then plummeted with the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, while in the early 1970s, after the advent of ping-pong diplomacy, the West embarked on the long love affair with the People's China, which lasted essentially up to the Tiananmen crackdown of 1989. The Soviet Union was now restored to relative favour after the coming of Gorbachev, and following his replacement by Yeltsin, hopes remained high that the new post-Soviet Russia would pursue a generally pro-Western course. Instead, the new Russia chose to make common cause with its old Chinese enemy, quietly building up year by year a political, military and economic partnership which has long since outlasted the much vaunted alliance of the 1950s. The West was initially slow to react to this new phenomenon, but by the early 2010s, Russia and China were habitually bracketed as the awkward squad in international diplomacy. And by the early 2020s, the two powers, Russia still bristling with its Soviet nuclear arsenal, China incomparably richer than it had been half a century earlier, and possessed of its own ever more high-tech armed forces and missiles, now posed a challenge that made comparisons with the Ottoman Empire seem a distinct understatement. The two powers have now come to be perceived as a kind of Eurasian Mordor, not merely confronting the West on land and at sea, in Ukraine or the Taiwan Straits, but threatening the internal security of Western countries through infiltration and the latest techniques of espionage and cyber warfare. Demonization, however, is not in itself a constructive response to the threat, and the close embrace between China and Russia calls for a rather deeper analysis. Over the years, I have glimpsed some of the inner workings of these two great countries from an admittedly privileged vantage point. As a boy in the 1960s and early 1970s, I accompanied my parents, the novelists C.P. Snow and Pamela Hansford Johnson, on visits they made to Russia as guests of the Soviet Writers' Union. This was not an exercise in fellow travelling, but reflected a deep conviction of my parents that in the conditions of the Cold War it was vital to maintain some kind of a dialogue, to persuade each side that not everyone on the other side had horns and tails. In the course of these visits we met a wide range of Soviet literary figures, Sholokhov, Simonov, Twardovsky, Yevtushenko, Aksionov, to name just a few, from hardliners to liberals and eventual dissidents. We met one or two individuals we guessed to have murky pasts, and others who were good people by any standards. We found much common ground, and sometimes also fought our own corner in ding-dong arguments. Through these visits, I also had the opportunity to travel to far-flung parts of the country, including Central Asia, Siberia, and the Soviet Far East. I was sufficiently enthused by my experiences to embark on a Russian language course back at school in England. In the meantime, however, my attention was caught by that other great pariah nation, the People's Republic of China, which was just coming out of the shadows at the end of the Cultural Revolution and was evidently destined to play an increasing part in all of our lives. In my second year at Oxford in 1972, I launched into a degree course in classical and modern Chinese, and for 3 years following my graduation in 1976 to 1979, I worked for the Sino-British Trade Council, escorting Chinese technical study groups around the United Kingdom and British trade missions venturing into remote parts of China. It was a wonderful opportunity to observe this immense land emerging from isolation and taking the first steps on its road to power and wealth. I remember the contrast between the nominal heads of the Chinese groups, Communist Party appointees to a man, no women, monolingual and lacking any obvious knowledge of the technologies their delegations had come to research, and the veteran scientists who accompanied them, educated as often as not in the West before 1949, typically English-speaking and relaxed and sophisticated in their worldview. I remember arriving by train one night with a British rail mission in the obscure northwestern city of Baoji to find the streets packed with thousands of people eager to observe the arrival of the first Europeans most of them had ever seen. Given this background, it was perhaps inevitable that my attention would focus at some point on the interaction between the two peoples. In 1973 to 1974, in the midst of my Oxford Chinese course, I spent some months at a language centre at Nanyang University in Singapore with a view to improving my spoken Mandarin. At this centre I encountered a team of a dozen or so young Russians who were also there to learn Mandarin because in the current climate of extreme Sino-Soviet hostility they had no prospect whatever of admission to Beijing. This encounter left me curious about the whole history of contact between the two powers, and on my return to Oxford I got permission to take as part of my final exams, under the supervision of Professor Mark Elvin, a paper of my own devising on Sino-Russian relations from 1644 to the present. It was a first step towards an eventual book. Conditions for researching a book about Sino-Russian relations at this time were far from ideal. The Sino-Soviet feud dragged on into the 1980s, and it was all too easy to get caught in the crossfire. On one occasion in 1980, when a Soviet correspondent came calling on my father in London, I was injudicious enough to allude to some Chinese friends of mine. I still remember the answering hiss of, "Your friends!" 2 years later, I was in Zimbabwe researching a book about Chinese relations with Africa and was given dinner by a husband and wife couple who ran the local branch of Xinhua, the new China news agency. In the course of a relaxed conversation, I talked quite freely about myself, my Chinese studies, and the visits I had made with my parents to the USSR. My last trip there, I recalled, had taken place in 1971. "And when did you say you started learning Chinese?" "In 1972. A pregnant pause. Happily, this exchange took place shortly after Brezhnev's speech in Tashkent, when Chinese wariness of the Soviet Union had begun to abate slightly, and any dark suspicions the Xinhua couple may have harboured had no repercussions for me. At the start of the 1990s, I began to think seriously about writing a Sino-Russian book. But the timing still seemed wrong. With the Soviet Union newly defunct and replaced by a shambolic new Russia, the way ahead seemed too murky to attempt such an exercise. By the late 2000s, with the new Sino-Russian partnership moving steadily forward along broadly predictable lines, the time seemed at last to have come. Soon after settling into my research, I was told that no fewer than 1,200 books on Sino-Russian relations were to be found in the U.S. Library of Congress. This was not, on the face of it, an encouraging revelation. But as I burrowed deeper into my sources, a new perspective began to take shape. The subject can be divided into a number of chronological segments, 8 by my reckoning, and each of these segments has been exhaustively studied by a legion of capable Chinese, Russian, and Western scholars. What has been largely missing, in the English language studies at any rate, has been an attempt to take a panoramic view of the entire 4 centuries of Sino-Russian contact and to tease out any patterns which might emerge from that vista. 2 exceptions have been China and Russia, The Great Game, by a former U.S. Foreign Service officer named O. Edmund Clubb, and Sino-Russian Relations, A Short History, by Rosemary Quested. But these works were published respectively in 1971 and 1984, and are long out of date. There seemed to me to be scope for an updated historical narrative, addressed primarily, though not exclusively, to the general reader, which would help to uncover the complexities underlying the current one-dimensional image of a Eurasian Mordor. The present book is the outcome of that calculation. At the most obvious level, I have sought to trace the shifts in the balance of Sino-Russian power. Which country has had the upper hand, when, and why? What political, economic, and technological factors have led to these changes? Has conflict or cooperation been the dominant state of affairs? What role has been played by third parties in pushing the two powers together or prizing them apart? To what extent has Russia been able to steal a march on the West in its dealings with China, and how far has this been the result of sheer physical closeness? Why have the two countries tussled incessantly for control of the borderland regions between them, yet have never taken the plunge into full-scale war? How far has ideology served to unite the two peoples, and how far has it been trumped by the forces of nationalism? Which of the two states has typically shown itself more afraid of the other? Beyond these macro questions, I've also tried to examine the human fundamentals. How have Chinese and Russians surmounted the language barrier, and what part has been played in this process by intermediaries? What effort has each country made at different periods to build up a specialist knowledge of the other side? Does an unbridgeable gulf separate Orthodox Christian Russians and Chinese with their heritage of Confucian thought, or have there been signs of a mutual attraction among intellectuals and artists or in the domain of popular culture? What personal ties have been forged in the process of doing business or making revolution? Have the periodic displays of racial hostility been more or less characteristic than the occurrences of romance and intermarriage? One final question which cries out for an answer is, naturally, how long will the current Sino-Russian partnership last? At the end of this book, I have sketched out a number of possible scenarios, but the prospects are opaque. Much depends on the rapidly changing Ukraine crisis, and it would be a fool's game to venture any definite prediction. Insofar as this quasi-alliance presents a menacing face to the West, it is only natural for Westerners to hope for a loosening of the current close ties. But no person of goodwill can surely wish to see these two peoples at each other's throats as they were in the near Armageddon of 1969. Is it too much to hope for a placid relationship among all the key players which would enable us to join forces in combating the larger dangers which threaten our planet as a whole? Philip Snow, Hong Kong, October 2022. Chapter 1. Worlds in Collision. In 1553, the explorer Richard Chancellor struggled ashore on the coast of the White Sea to make the first English landfall on Russian soil. Invited to Moscow by Tsar Ivan the Terrible, he successfully opened a Russian market for English woolen cloth and made his name as the pioneer of Anglo-Russian relations. But Russia had not, in fact, been the original object of Chancellor's journey. His main purpose had been to discover a northeast passage that would provide access to the fabled riches of China. English interest had been piqued by the publication, respectively in 1544 and 1549, in Denmark and Germany, of two maps purporting to show the river Ob, westernmost of the great Siberian rivers, flowing out of a Lake Cathay. During a second visit to Russia in 1555, as representative of a newly formed Muscovy company, Chancellor spent time closeted with the Tsar in an effort to find out the details of this northern route. While a volume that appeared in the same year in England was entitled, hopefully, On the North-East Frosty Seas and the Kingdoms Lying That Way. Chancellor's talks led to nothing, but the English kept up the pressure. During the early years of the 17th century, the merchant John Merrick, established by the Muscovy Company as their permanent agent in Moscow, bombarded the Tsarist court with repeated requests for an English expedition to cross Russian territory in search of both the river and the supposed Chinese lake. In 1608, he submitted a first letter to this effect from King James I's government to the Tsar Vasily Shuisky. In 1612, he offered to mediate, in exchange for the hoped-for permission, in the current war between Russia and Sweden, and in 1617, bitterly acknowledging his lack of progress so far, he sweetened his proposal by tabling it in the form of a joint venture in which the English side would cover the costs. The Muscovy that was being besieged by these English petitions was still a fairly rudimentary state. In 1460, it had emerged from nearly 200 years of Mongol domination. The rule of the Mongol Golden Horde had bequeathed to the Russians a legacy in the form of a few techniques of administration, a certain amount of vocabulary, including the words for treasury, money, and customs, and the wearing of Central Asian skullcaps and kaftans, but also a psychological scarring and a deep horror of invasion from the East. Agriculture was poor. Law and scholarship were undeveloped. Bureaucracy was basic, with a crude foreign ministry, the Posolsky Prikaz, emerging only in the mid-16th century, and by the time Merrick started to press his demands, the country was being convulsed by the mixture of civil conflict and Polish and Swedish invasion remembered as the time of troubles. Still, the Russians were already showing some evidence of their future vigour. By the late 15th century, they were beginning to push their frontiers eastwards, largely, it seems, to fend off the prospect of any further Mongol assaults. In 1483 and 1499, their reconnaissances had reached as far as the Ob, hence the awareness of that river which had filtered through to the Danish and German cartographers. A century later, the Cossacks, a caste of fugitive peasants and freebooters who made their homes on the frontiers and served as the spearhead of the Russian advance, were establishing their first permanent footholds in Siberia, drawn by the lure of the soft gold, the fur of the sables, martens, arctic foxes, and other creatures that teemed in the Siberian forests. In 1579, the Cossack Yermak Timofeyevich, sponsored by the Stroganov brothers, merchants who in turn had the tacit consent of Tsar Ivan the Terrible, crossed the Ural Mountains with an armed band, and in 1582 he attacked and eliminated the neighbouring Tatar kingdom of Sibir. Over the next quarter century, the Cossacks went on to found the two major townships of western Siberia, Tobolsk in 1587 and Tomsk in 1604. But where China was concerned, the Russian endeavour seemed oddly sluggish by comparison with that of the English and other Western Europeans. At the height of the Eurasian Empire, which the Mongols created in the 13th century, in the great Khan's capital of Karakorum, Russian goldsmiths had rubbed shoulders with Chinese artisans. A 14th-century Russian chronicler referred to China as another country subdued by the Mongols, and Russian linguistic borrowings from the Mongols included their name for China, Kitai. Archaeologists have discovered near the town of Saratov, on the Volga, evidence for at least some degree of indirect trading in the form of a flowered brocade Chinese gown and a quantity of decorated Chinese bronze mirrors from the time of the Golden Horde. But little, if any, of this early contact seems to have lingered in the collective memory of post-Mongol Russia. Popular knowledge of China appears to have been limited to a vague notion of a distant Oriental realm. A fairy tale entitled Ivan Bogatyr, the Peasant's Son, tells of a youth who rides to the land of Kitai in 30 days and 30 nights. There he meets the three daughters of the Chinese Tsar, Duaza, Spasa, and Lao Ta, and falls in love with the youngest, Lao Ta. He defends China from the attacks of the marauding army of Polkan, and eventually wins both the hand of Lao Ta and the Chinese throne. Any interest in trading with China seems to have been of a distinctly passive kind. Occasional Russian traders made their way to the markets of Samarkand and other cities of Central Asia, where they haggled alongside their Chinese counterparts, but none of them was apparently tempted to follow the Chinese to their point of origin. In 1466 to 1472, a particularly enterprising merchant named Afanasy Nikitin penetrated as far as India, but contented himself with referring in his account of the journey to a country called China, which could be reached from India by land in 6 months and by sea in 4 days. There they make porcelain, and their goods are all very cheap. In 1582, the year Yermak conquered Sibir, Ivan the Terrible planned to move matters forward by sending a group to Siberia to investigate the possible opening of a trade route to China. But the project was abandoned when Ivan died in March 1584. Merrick's pressures, however, spurred the Moscow government into belated action. Sluggish though they had been up till now, the Russians were quite clear that they didn't want interlopers from England monopolizing their transit trade and possibly even threatening their precarious settlements in western Siberia. Already in 1608, in the thick of the time of troubles, Tsar Vasily Shuisky reacted to Merrick's first overture by instructing the governor of the new township of Tomsk to send out a reconnaissance mission to gather information on China for Russia's benefit from the nearest Mongol chief. No longer a united empire, the Mongols were divided into two main warring branches, the Dzhungars and the Khalkhas, and the Russian mission was directed to a Khalkha ruler, the Altin Khan, Golden Prince, who at this time held sway in northwestern Mongolia. The Russian mission arrived to discover that the Altin Khan had been put to flight by his Dzungar enemies, and the expedition was given up. By 1616, the time of troubles was over. The Russian throne was occupied by the youthful Tsar Michael, first sovereign of the Romanov dynasty, and Moscow was ready for a more determined reconnaissance. Two fresh deputations were now sent off, this time from Tobolsk. A mission to the Dzungars came back with reports of a land to the east with stone-built walls and a city it took 10 days to ride round, full of temples and a mighty ringing of bells. Corn grew plentifully, and the people possessed an abundance of satins and velvets, gold and silver. Their domain was protected by muskets and cannon and frequented by big sailing ships. Emissaries to the Altin Khan were told similarly of a land with a brick wall around it and given Chinese silk and a first taste of tea. The Altin Khan was delighted to offer his Russian neighbours access to the China trade in return for supplies of firearms and furs, and he even sent two envoys back with a reconnaissance party to Moscow, where in 1617 Merik, newly returned from fulfilling his promise to fix up a peace settlement between Russia and Sweden, was amazed, and no doubt disconcerted, to run into them at a banquet given by the Tsar. The Council of Boyars, advising Tsar Michael, now felt in a position to see off the English challenge. They kept a long-standing promise to hold a negotiation with Merik about his China scheme, but their answer was a definitive no. They were not prepared to allow English traders to search for the Ob, not even in the context of a joint Anglo-Russian endeavour, though they did kindly offer to ask their Siberian governors to collect information about the river on Merik's behalf. They tried their best to persuade Merik of the impossibility of going to China. In any case, they observed, there was no point in going there since the country was a poor one. It was, furthermore, surrounded by a brick wall, and therefore it can be known that the place is not large. In the meantime, they hurriedly set about launching a China expedition of their own. On 9 May 1618, a 12-man exploratory party set out from Tomsk under the leadership of Ivan Petlin, Ivashko, as he is often referred to in the casual style of the period, a Cossack who served as a government clerk and seems to have had some knowledge of the Mongolian language. Escorted by two Buddhist lamas supplied to them by the Altin Khan, Petlin's group made their way on horseback across the Mongolian steppe until they encountered a wall built of stone about 15 sajens high. They followed this wall for 10 days before turning south and eventually arrived in Peking in early September. The report written by Petlin after his return to Russia was suffused with awe at the glimpse of another civilization more advanced and prosperous than his own. Coming from a land where the buildings were almost all wooden, he was fascinated above all by the Chinese use of masonry, and his record was full of allusions to Chinese stone and brick. Peking, for example, had streets paved with grey stone, and stone shops with brick dwellings over the shops, and the other cities he passed were all stone-walled. He was not quite prepared to concede explicitly the superiority of Chinese cities to Russian ones, but he observed that the border town of Kalgan was good, a fine affair, and the towers are as high as those of Moscow. Chinese markets were bursting not merely with velvets, damasks and silks, but with melons and watermelons, cucumbers, garlic, radishes, onions, turnips, cabbages, parsnips, horseradish, rhubarb, and other fruits and vegetables such as we know not. And when you walked along the shop rows in Huailai, you smelt a fragrance of cooking that seems to have come from heaven. The inhabitants came and went in crowds, like flies going to and fro, but the people of both sexes in China were clean. Petlin's chief reservation related to the temples, to his Orthodox Christian eyes crammed with idols. As in Mongolia, he lamented, they frighten you. But he was also struck to note that the Chinese let anyone in to look at the temples. Petlin's group were received by officials of the reigning Ming dynasty and installed in a cavernous hostel which the Ming government used to accommodate foreign missions. Ming China, like Muscovy, had emerged from the shadow of Mongol power. The rule of the Yuan-Mongol dynasty over China from 1279 to 1368 had been near...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?